172 Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Miquette. Oh, no, that was only one episode, and that was a long time ago. I'm sorry. My co-host is, in fact, Barry Rose, and he's with me today. Barry, how you doing, my man?
I'm doing so. Am
I throw
you
a curveball every once in a while?
Yeah. Am I the special guest this week? Is that
you are no Randall Pink Floyd, my friend. I'll just say that the pride of Nashua High School in Nashua.
Where?
Anyway, private joke. So today on episode 172, we're going a little light on the wrestling content. I think it's fair to say we are going to be looking at a match from April 15th, 1995. Barry, let me ask you a question. Have we ever, in the history of this fine Peabody award-winning podcast, ever done a match from ECW?
I think we did once, and we're going back 3 years ago. It's a long time. I think we did one match from ECW.
Okay. Well, we are going back to the hallowed halls of the ECW arena for the Hostile City Showdown as Raven, who I picked in my top five best gimmicks, will be taking on Tommy Dreamer. And we'll have fun talking about that. But the majority of the show today, I think it's safe to say, we will be talking movies and television shows that we have both started watching or finished, and that we're going to recommend the movie that we're going to be watching. We have a couple of fine reviews sent in from three of our listeners and friends from the Facebook group. That is the incredible No Country for Old Men from the Coen Brothers. And it's amazing. I sat and rewatched it today. I was telling Barry and Luke before we started recording. We are going to be, like I said, also mentioning a couple shows we watched recently, and I'm going to make Barry very happy. I told him beforehand, we're going to be asking Barry a food question. Nothing gets Barry more excited than talking about food. Am I right, Barry?
We could do 6 hours of food and it still wouldn't be enough for me. So yes.
Well, no, as absolutely. Long as I throw in like a dog story or something like that.
Dogs and food. That's it. Dogs
and food. Wrestling. Fuck.
Whatever. But it's Jeff, if we were going to stick to wrestling.
I see what you did there. That was very clever.
Yeah. If we were going to do there's 8,000 wrestling podcasts out there. And certainly we want to be a little different. So I like that though. Food, dogs, and maybe the occasional boobs.
So and we'll be well. Okay, you don't want to talk about Victor Rivera and Johnny Ross?
You mean headlining witches? I want to spend 60 minutes.
And the girl I was dating that week. Yeah, okay. All right, we're getting a little too intimate here. So yes, we are. Before we get to our match, okay, which was a fun match and we have lots to discuss there. Why don't we lead off the show by talking about from 2007. The Coen Brothers, fantastic Academy Award winner for Best Picture, No Country for Old Men. Barry, I had seen this movie before, sat down when I got home, because I'm nothing if not diligent here in my efforts on the podcast, and rewatched No Country for Old Men. Just to remind the good folks out there listening, I had picked Javier Bardem's performance as Anton Chigurh. I said, this is an epic performance. He was in our list of best villains in cinematic history. I think he was like in the top 10, Barry. Just a crazy, crazy good movie. We have three people that took the bait and volunteered to review the film. But first of all, Barry, tell us your memories of this film.
I mean, I think this is maybe in the of great films. I don't know if it hits my favorite. You know, there's that where you recognize a film is great, and then you've got your favorites. And I think partly because I don't know how often, you know, I can watch Big Lebowski probably every day. I sat down, I watched Midnight Run last night after I watched There Will Be Blood. And I've seen Midnight Run at least 100 times. But with that, this movie, I think, is one of the greatest movies ever made. I think when you look at it, the way it was directed, the acting, the storyline's great, but the whole ambiance of this film and Javier Bardem, how he's not, because this movie's what, like 15, 13, 12 years old at this point.
Exactly.
How he is not a bigger star at this stage, I'm not really sure, because I think this is one of the great performances. And Jeff, you were 100% correct.
Check.
When you chose him to be one of the great movie villains. And I think I backed you up on that. And I said, yeah. And it's a lot of it has to do with the originality of the murder weapon, the air gun. You know, is it an air gun? Is it a cattle gun? Is it the captive bolt pistol? It's the same shit. It does the same thing, but nobody's ever done that before. And he is so evil in his presentation. First off, the hairstyle. I mean, that hairstyle, what is that? That's just insane. But you did mention that this movie won Best Picture. It also won Best Director. It was nominated for 8 Academy Awards. It also won Best Supporting Actor, which went to Javier Bardem, and Best Screenplay. So it really just did a, swept up at the Oscars and did a great job with that. More critics actually included this movie on their top 10 list for the year 2007 than any other film. And here's the kicker. This movie is recognized as the Coen Brothers' best film of all time. Certainly, I've got something to say about that, but I could see it. This is a work of art. This is at a different level than the average film. And it's not the kind of thing where lightning's going to strike twice. This is an incredible piece of cinema right here. But with that, Jeff, as we're talking about this, and it had me thinking, first off, obviously Big Lebowski is my favorite Coen Brothers movie. But if I said to you, what are your top 5 favorite Coen Brothers movies? What would your responses be?
I don't think
this is an easy question, Jeff, because when you start to go through their catalog of films, you're like, how could I not include this one in my top 5? But the truth is there's 8 that could be in the top 5.
Yeah. I'm going to have to, say, besides this one, let's go with, Lebowski. I'm going to go with, Fargo has to be in there. Hudsucker Proxy. Oh, Miller's Crossing. Let's take out Hudsucker Proxy. Miller's Crossing, Raising Arizona, which is crazy good. Blood Simple was their first big mainstream movie, and that's a really good movie. I don't know if you've seen that one lately. Yeah, so that's where I'd go.
It's fantastic. So we are, I think we're in agreement completely. I've got Lebowski, Blood Simple, No Country for Old Men, Fargo, and Raising Arizona. So we're really right about there with that as well. Blood Simple that you touched on too, and I think I've told this story. The first time I ever saw Blood Simple was probably within a year of its release, and I was watching it on videotape, and I started watching it at midnight, and I was so enthralled with this film. You got Dan Hedaya, who was on Cheers for years, playing the slimy bar owner. And Frances McDormand, it plays his wife. She's married to one of the Coen brothers. I don't know which one, but you've got the great, what's his name? M. Emmett Walsh.
Yes. Yes. I was trying to figure
out.
He played the private eye.
Yes.
In Blood Simple. Yeah.
And do you remember that great scene? This is where I knew I was hooked. He puts his hand in the window and she puts a knife through his hand. And I just remember going, holy shit. And nowadays stuff like that is commonplace. But back then that was a very riveting moment. I just think Blood Simple, which was their first film, their first major theatrical release, fantastic film. But this movie is really just incredible on so many levels. A couple of facts, Jeff. I know you like when I throw out some of these obscure facts. The role of Llewellyn Moss was originally offered to Heath Ledger, the late Heath Ledger, very great actor. He turned it down. He wanted to spend more time with his daughter, Matilda. I believe Michelle Williams, the actress, is the mother. Garrett Dillahunt was also in the running for the role. You may not know who Garrett Dillahunt is.
Oh, yes, I do. He was in Deadwood.
Yeah, there you go. He's also in Fear the Walking Dead and does a great job in Fear the Walking Dead. Really, really good actor. And Garrett Dillahunt apparently auditioned 5 times for the role, but instead was offered the part of Wendell. And Josh Brolin was not on the Coen's list at all. He actually got the help of Quentin Tarantino and Robert Rodriguez to make an audition reel for him. His agent eventually secured a meeting with the Coens. He was given the part, and he really did a great job. I think Josh Brolin, too, is one of those guys really underrated as an actor on a lot of different levels. But this movie is, I would say, is about as good as you're going to get. This is that good of a movie. And let me ask you a question, Jeff. When this movie is over, and you watched it today, so this is fresh. Is it what do you feel like? Because I remember this when the movie was over for me, I remember feeling anxious. Like I felt anxious. Did you feel that today?
Like in what respect?
Just that I think this is such a roller coaster ride on so many levels. And he's so evil that at times I felt myself like the first time I watched it, I was like white knuckling my couch. you know, because I was like gripping on. And I just remember when the movie was over, I almost felt like a sense of relief, but at the same time, I was like really anxious. Like it could have been all the alcohol too. Who
knows? Well, it could be that too, or the edibles, of course. So here's, first of all, we have not mentioned the guy that's the lead in the movie, and that's the incredible Tommy Lee Jones, who I have to say, says more with his face, just like looking down, like at the you know, I was just watching, there's a scene where he walks in a motel room and they're doing like a backlight on his face and all the lines in his face. And you can just see the history of this guy, the character this guy plays of Ed Tom Bell, the sheriff. And I love the scenes where the deputy comes in and he's just sitting at the diner and he's reading the paper and he goes, did you hear about this case out in California where the people would rent a room to the people and they'd kill them and they'd bury them in the backyard. And before they do that, they torture them. Why would they do that? And just like the way that he reads that scene is just like so unbelievably good. Let me real quick run down some of the cast because it's an incredible cast. You got Tommy Lee Jones, Javier Bardem, Josh Brolin, Woody Harrelson. Holy crap. Let me point out how much I love in everything I've ever seen her in, Kelly MacDonald. Of course, besides this movie, Barry, she's famous for?
She's famous for Boardwalk Empire.
You are exactly right. And two completely yes. different accents. She plays an Irish immigrant in Boardwalk Empire. In this, she's this girl from South Texas, and she nails both the accents really good. Garrett Dillahunt, you mentioned. Tess Harper, who I believe had been nominated for a Best Supporting Actor. What was the movie with Robert Duvall?
Don't tell me. What's the name? Fences.
Lou, help us out, buddy. Anyway, there's also the great Barry Corbin. Barry Corbin, who was, of course, famously Uncle Bud in Urban Cowboy. Stephen Root, who's great in everything he does. Let me also point out, you know, you talk about how I was just
sitting there. That's my stapler. That's right.
I was just thinking about, I love a movie that is over 2 hours long where a character is in the movie probably less than 2 minutes, but you remember her. And that is Beth Grant, who plays Carla Jean's mom, who's got the cancer. And she mentions that about 10 times in the space of 2 minutes. You know how many people I know in El Paso right there? Zero. And she's just like a force of nature for 2 minutes. It's great. Tender Mercies was the name of the Robert Duvall movie.
Tender Mercies. That's it.
Tess Harper was in. So, you know, you are looking at an incredible cast. I mean, just amazing. And, you know, just certainly kudos because they nailed everything. So I am going to throw a couple of things at you, Barry, that I found of a trivial nature, though you're the one that usually likes to say that you are the only one that does that. I mentioned to Barry before we started going, the movie is set in 1980. And what happened was that's when the story was set, because in 1979, federal judge John Howland Wood was shot and killed in San Antonio by Texas freelance contract killer. Is that the kind of stuff you advertise in the paper, by the way? Named Charles Harrelson, father of Woody, who happens to be in the movie. That's kind of ironic, I would say. Let's see. Now, this is something that I loved. You didn't mention, Barry. According to a January 2018 article in Business Insider, a group of psychiatrists studied 400 movies and identified 126 psychopathic characters within those movies. They chose Javier Bardem's portrayal of Anton Chigurh as the most clinically accurate portrayal of a psychopath. That's how well he nailed this performance. And holy shit, you just, you know, it's just absolutely amazing. So there's so many, and I have to say, this is the rare movie that I really liked and I thought was a great movie that has, spoiler alert, a scene where a dog is killed. Usually if there's a dog killed in a movie, right, count me out, but it involves a character. I don't want to spoil anything for a 14-year-old movie here, but a character is running for his life, being chased by a dog. And to save himself, he has to kill the dog with a shot from a pistol. But, you know, the movie, if I had to ask, if somebody asked me for a plot, I'd say it's about a guy who stumbles upon a crime scene, makes an incredibly bad choice of trying to steal money from the cartel, which, by the way, Barry, I don't know if you know that, but that's a real bad idea.
And that's a bad idea.
The cartel sends a contract killer out to get the guy and get the money back. And in doing so, the contract killer, Anton Chigurh, he is essentially what Schwarzenegger was in The Terminator, because nothing stops this guy. He will not rest until he sees you and kills you with that. As Barry said, what are they called? A bolt.
Yeah. It's like an air gun. It's a,
it's apparently the gun they use to stun cattle before they kill them, you know? Right. So, and it blows locks out of doors, and it's a weapon that, before this film, I believe, had never been used as a weapon of death, shall we say, in any movie. Just fantastic. So, Barry, before we pontificate any further, why don't we go to our film reviews? I will point out the three gentlemen that helped us out are Michael Phillips, Jeff Lewis, and Daniel Williams. Gentlemen, friend of the Facebook group, friend of the show, and we are now going to give the reviews. We always tell the guys, don't give us the plot summary. Just tell us pros, cons, whether you liked the movie, whether you didn't like it. Try to keep it brief because, you know, quite frankly, we don't want to read a 4-page, you know, film review that, you know, recounts the plot of the movie, because chances are Barry and I are going to do that. So, Barry, I am going to take the review of Michael Phillips first, okay? You can take the middle one. So, Michael Phillips, No Country for Old Men. The pros: Javier Bardem as hitman Anton Chigurh steals every scene he is in. He is the impending doom of the movie, much like the shark in Jaws or Arnold Schwarzenegger in the first Terminator movie. There's no stopping him. He is the movie's high point, the penultimate. He didn't write that. I said that, Barry. The mood and setting of a Texas border town in the early 1980s help establish that this is a much simpler time before cell phones, social media, and even in some cases, air conditioning. The cast is top-notch also, with Tommy Lee Jones, who can be a very good actor when he's not hamming it up, Josh Brolin, and Woody Harrelson. The cons: I have to say there is one thing I had an issue with, the ending. I felt that after almost 2 hours, I felt like there was going to be a resolution, which also involves Josh Brolin's character. To me, it felt like watching an exciting wrestling match where someone is getting their leg worked over only to submit to an armbar. So, before we go to your review, Barry, I am going to give a spoiler review, and I will give you 5 seconds to step away from the spoiler. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Okay, Barry, let's talk about the ending. He gets away with it at the end. Yes. Javier Bardem. Josh Brolin's character is killed, not by Javier Bardem, but by some other cartel members that were out looking for him. And so, this is the kind of movie, I will be honest with you, my wife completely hates when the guy gets away with it at the end. So, did you have a problem with the ending?
I don't think I did. I get what your wife is saying, because there are certain things in films that if it happens, it kind of really screws up the film for me. That's not one of them. I can take that people getting away at the end. We were talking about this off air, another spoiler alert coming up, but I watched, I always get these two movies confused, and then you explain why, Jeff, but I watched There Will Be Blood instead of this film, and I had seen both before, and you mentioned that they were actually filmed at the same time, like just a couple of miles apart. But in that film, essentially, the Daniel Day-Lewis character, which is Daniel Plainview, also gets away with murder. He commits a murder at the very end. And, you know, does he get away with it? We don't see what happens 6 months later. But essentially, as far as we know, he does get away with it. It doesn't ruin the film for me in the slightest at all.
No, and I think in some way it would cheapen the film if he just was random. Well, you know, okay, at the end of the film, he gets in a car accident. If he had been killed in the car accident, it would have been like, much like, you know, Michael described, it would have been a guy that worked over your leg the entire match and then submits to an armbar. That's what it would have been like if he had been killed in the car accident at the end of the movie. But he walks away from the car accident, albeit with a gruesome injury. And but to me, that made the character, if not the movie, the character more memorable. So now, Barry, why don't you go to the review by Jeff Lewis and tell us what Jeff thought about the movie.
Yeah, and I like that too, Jeff, and I think you're right about that as well. I for me, it it wouldn't make a difference. In some ways, I actually prefer that they do get away, because the formula is, you know, commit the crime and then pay, do the time. And when somebody can, you know, it's different, it's original. And if somebody commits a murder and they're not held accountable in the film and they're able to get away with it, I think that's great, because you're kind of bucking what the normal formula is. So I like it. Jeff Lewis, and our condolences go out to Jeff. Jeff wrote a very heartfelt message in our Facebook group this week about the loss of his father. So may he rest in peace. But Jeff wrote a really fantastic review. It definitely has a Coen Brothers feel to it. Similar to Fargo, the vastness of the land has a lot to do with the beginning of the movie. The initial scenes where Llewellyn finds the money are also reminiscent of the opening of Paris, Texas, the last film I got to review, and a personal favorite of Jeff and mine. They are also very few likable characters throughout this movie. Similar to Fargo, Jerry's father-in-law, Jerry the kidnappers, Shep Proudfoot in Fargo and in No Country for Old Men, Llewellyn, the different gangs trying to recover the money, Carson Wells. The other similarity between this film and other Coen Brothers classics is the narration. Similar to Sam Elliott's Cowboy and The Big Lebowski, Tommy Lee Jones's voiceover at the start of the film helps set the stage. If you like the Coen Brothers films, this is a must-see. There are a ton of great character actors with small parts. Stephen Root, Barry Corbin, Tess Harper, and of course Woody Harrelson, who's great in everything. And Jeff, you obviously mentioned all those people that add to the story. I enjoyed the lack of soundtrack. This whole movie is about ramping up the tension during the pursuit of Llewellyn by the villain and the havoc that the villain wreaks throughout the film. The silence just helps ramp up the tension to the breaking point. The best part of this movie is the villain, Anton Chigurh. Recently, when the Facebook group had a post of who was the best movie villains, this was my first thought. Overly sinister, no remorse whatsoever, yet exuding a calm exterior throughout his killing and terrorizing. He's almost machine-like in his pursuits. For a wrestling analogy, his low-key delivery is similar to Jody Hamilton's promos as the Assassin, which were scary as hell when I was younger and getting into wrestling. All in all, a fantastic film and well-deserving of the Oscars it won for Best Pick, Best Direction, Best Screenplay, and Best Supporting Actor for Javier Bardem. If you split the Coens' work into comedy movies, think Raising Arizona, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, The Hudsucker Proxy, versus the dramas, Fargo, Blood Simple, the remake of True Grit, then this movie is the equivalent on the dramatic side of the ledger to The Big Lebowski. 5 stars from Jeff Lewis. Excellent review, Jeff.
Yes, thank you so much. And also, Barry, I will ask you to join me. We raise an adult beverage to the memory of Jeff's father. Salute.
Hear, hear.
And let's go to Daniel Williams' review. Daniel Williams writes, a great movie that leaves little to be desired. This is my first time watching No Country for Old Men, but I've heard a lot about it for a long time. The Coen brothers don't put their names on junk. This film continued in their long tradition of putting out quality movies. They've developed wonderful, strong characters that stir emotions. None stir more emotion than Javier Bardem's Anton, the stone-cold killer, and his ruthless path of destruction he leaves everywhere he goes. And for every bad guy, you need a good guy. While Josh Brolin's Llewellyn doesn't have spotless character, he's trying to do the best he can, trying to run from Anton and make sure his wife is safe. The only loose ends I felt were Tommy Lee Jones' Sheriff Bell. While he retired and survived Anton, I don't feel like I get the complete story with him, and his lack of interaction with Anton directly leaves a desire to see it. Running out the great ensemble cast with a set of short, albeit short appearances from Woody Harrelson and Stephen Root, better known for his role in Office Space as Milton, I, of course, personally would have gone to his role in Dodgeball, but that's just me. A fine set of supporting actors made for a pretty tight cast that didn't have much cruft, and everyone played their roles well. All in all, I thoroughly enjoyed the movie and would suggest to anyone that likes a vicious villain and a good full action story with plenty of destruction and suspense. The small issues are decidedly small, and the fear put into you as Anton wreaks havoc across the Southwest will hold your attention well. Very good review. Thank you, Daniel. And guys, we do appreciate your thoughts. So obviously all three in agreement with you and I, Barry, that this is a fantastic movie. I just want to offer a couple of points. Number one, as far as trivia, I forgot to mention this. The opening scene. That's not actually the opening scene, but the scene very, very early in the film when Josh Brolin's character of Llewellyn stumbles upon what is a drug deal gone sour. I think that's pretty safe to assume, where there's rampant destruction and murder and blood everywhere. One of the trivial notes that I found about the Coen brothers was that because of where they were filming, they were out in the middle of literally, it's not the desert, but it's like the middle of nowhere. And they spent a little bit extra money on this particular type of fake blood. And one of the reasons they gave for spending the extra money was because if they had just used, you know, like a clear syrup and put some food coloring in it, they were worried that the entire cast and the set would be beset by flies. So they spent a little extra money on the high grade fake blood, which I thought was pretty funny, Barry. Now let's talk about the end of the movie with Tommy Lee Jones and his interaction with Anton Chigurh, or what was perceived as a lack of interaction. However, there was the scene at the motel where Tommy Lee Jones is going into the hotel room, and you see the cutaway to Anton Chigurh is behind a door, like waiting. And there's, I think what I got out of that scene was that Tommy Lee Jones realized this was somebody the likes of which he had never come across before, and that he was not physically capable of handling. Am I off base there, Bear?
No, I think I'd agree with that too. And I think what I liked about Tommy Lee Jones's character, there's an intelligence in his character. And as with that, you know, a lot of what Tommy Lee Jones does, he comes across as in real life, I believe he went to Harvard, right?
Yes.
So yeah.
So roommates with Al Gore.
Right. So you're talking somebody who really is intelligent, but at the same time, his characters generally are of a higher intelligence. And I think you can see that. So I like that, but that also in a lot of ways, that kind of bucks the formula, right? Much like we're talking about Anton getting away at the end, essentially with murder, that's different also. That's a different aspect. And I think you've got to give the Coen brothers a lot of credit.
Yeah. And there's a couple of very quiet scenes. There's the scene I talked about before where he's reading the newspaper and reading about the crimes that are happening in California. There's the scene where he's talking with the sheriff of the town that he's come to, where the massacre at the hotel has taken place, and they're talking about how times have changed and you know, the difference in the criminals that they're now going after. And maybe that's the effect of the drug industry and the cartels and stuff. And then at the end, when he goes out and he's come to realize that, you know, the title No Country for Old Men, he's the old man, and that this is, he's a man out of time, this character of Ed Tom. And he realizes that he's not physically or maybe emotionally capable of doing his job anymore, as he runs into killers that are just like machines at this point. And so, you know, hence the title of the movie. I cannot recommend this movie highly enough. It's absolutely fantastic. And so, yeah, definitely, Barry, this is one worth seeking out.
Oh, absolutely, too. And it's a, you know, this is the kind of thing, too, is that if you haven't seen a lot of the Coen brothers films, this is, you know, I think a pandemic is a great time to jump in, you know, as we're all, yeah, a lot no, of us are home. That's, yeah, exactly.
Absolutely right about that.
Fucking okay, knock Barry, this out. Yes.
Now let's go to April 15th, 1995, Hostile City Showdown. It is Raven versus Tommy Dreamer. So before we start talking about the match, Barry, let's give a little, you know, a retrospective, a look back on ECW. ECW, of course, was the brainchild of Paul Heyman. And, you know, there's a lot you can say pro and con about Paul Heyman. And, you know, the character of Raven was certainly one of, you know, whether it was his brainchild or whether it was Scott Levy coming up with the character, but it was a fantastic character. So much about the character and the fact that in this feud between Raven and Tommy Dreamer, they made it like that these kids had known each other going back to grade school, and they incorporated Beulah, and Beulah was always what Raven and Tommy Dreamer were fighting over as school kids. That was really brilliant storytelling.
It absolutely was too. And if you think about it, there are a few promotions, like if the WWE had tried this, it would have been completely botched. It would have been comedy. it would have come off as something ridiculous. It came off as that there was a real vendetta. And if you listen to, there's a great interview and a promo that takes place beforehand with Stevie Richards, Raven, and Beulah. And Stevie Richards is talking about Beulah. She used to weigh 320 pounds and her face was covered in zits. And Tommy Dreamer treated her like shit and wouldn't give her the time of day. And she only had one friend at camp. And it was Raven, you know, and it was just like, yeah, that is, it's compelling and it's original, but at the same time, it wasn't being played up for comedy, you know? And I think if any of the bigger companies had tried something like that, it would have come off completely ridiculous. ECW, they completely made it work though, Jeff.
Well, and you know, honestly, when the character of Raven, moved to WCW, it lost all its momentum. They did not understand. And that's the madness and the genius of Paul Heyman on one side of the equation. You have the other side where, you know, there's let's be honest. There's a lot of when I said pro and con, let's just say I wasn't kidding entirely to Paul Heyman, you know, because he did a great job. He worked not only the fans, he worked the guys in the company. But that was part of the mad evil genius. That's why Paul Heyman is so effective, because, you know, a guy like Paul Heyman, if Paul Heyman had been made booker of, say, WCW, okay, Paul Heyman needed as booker what I would call the proverbial strong pimp hand. He needs a guy that would sit there and keep his eyes on the ball and not let him stray too far, because that's what happened. He did not have that in ECW. So what you had was you had incredible angles like Raven and Tommy Dreamer, like stuff like when they later incorporated the Sandman and the Sandman's son. And for every great angle, then you had stuff where it just kind of started going completely off the rails. And, you know, the violence uptick to me just started getting really disturbing. Like if you see some of the guys that were in ECW, you know, here some 20 plus years later, they're looking a little bit, you know, road weary, shall we say. Much, you know, we talked about the guys that had worked the King's Road style in All Japan and what they look like now. And guys like Raven and some of the other guys like Sandman that, you know, every night seemingly would bleed. It's just, it took a toll on the, you know, the physical pounding or the chair shots, the garbage can shots. And there are some in this particular match that are pretty heavy duty. It's one thing to do that for a special show, but these guys were doing it almost on a nightly basis, Bear.
They were too. And then there was the lifestyle that went along with it.
Which just a little bit.
Yeah, just a little, with the recreational activities that apparently were taking place in the locker room before and after matches, then at hotels. And you have to wonder, like, I don't think any of this could actually take place in the U.S. today. If you're talking a major promotion that actually has a television, I don't think that, you know, what was taking place could actually happen today. And as we were discussing in the Facebook group, Paul Varlins passed away over the last couple of days. And there was an infamous story. Do you remember that story, Jeff?
I know they did the angle with him, and it was Taz, right?
Was he and Taz? And I guess he was balking at doing the job for Taz. You know, A, you've got a guy who was a legitimate UFC star who's probably a foot and a half taller than Taz. And at this point, Taz was the human suplex machine and, you know, whatever he was. But Heyman did such a great, he was a great promoter in that sense. He did such a great job in building up Taz that people were actually believing that Taz was really this unstoppable machine. Well, Paul Varlins wasn't buying it, and he kind of wasn't, he didn't want a job to him. And it was supposed to be, I think, like less than a minute was supposed to be the job. And allegedly, because we always want to put the alleged out there, that
supposition.
Yeah. Supposition that Paul Heyman asked Missy Hyatt to go in and do a favor for Paul Varlins in order to get him to actually job to Taz. That was the big story going around for years. And, you know, it's whether it's true or not, that was out there. And I believe it was true from what I've heard. But that is the genius of what Heyman does. So to that, this is it's a good match. There's nothing here. I think this is a good match that's representative of ECW. And I think, you know, there's nothing here that's going to make you say, oh, my God, I can't believe it. Tommy Dreamer is one of those guys. he's still active, Jeff. You probably don't watch, you know, Impact, but he's on Impact almost every week. He is, in my opinion, he's terrible. He's in his 50s. He's a horrific actor. Stephen Jaworski right now is probably getting a lawyer to come after me because I'm slandering Impact. But I think
you should probably be more worried about Missy.
Yeah. But that's a legend on that one.
A legend. And it's Rose, yeah. R-O-S-E.
So. Yes, exactly. That's M-C-A-D-A-M. And yes, and I live at Witchy's in Nashua. But it's a good match. I mean, is there anything here that's out of the ordinary other than maybe that Tommy Dreamer was very creative when it came to his weapons? There is the kitchen sink because there is toy dinosaur. Yes. There is a dozen eggs. And got to admit, when he hits Raven with a dozen eggs, Raven sells out like $1 million. like, come on, of all things.
Yeah. But he sells. I will say, if someone said, give me an example of what ECW was about, as opposed to show me a fantastic, you know, they had the Mexican guys in, Eddie, Benoit, Malenko, and those matches were unbelievable. But if you want to see a representation of what ECW was about in this time frame, the crazy storylines, the crazy brilliant storylines, I'll give them that, of Paul Heyman with Raven and Dreamer and Beulah McGillicuddy, who certainly didn't look 300 pounds in this pic, you know, thing. And, you know, and the way the crowd interacted as part of this, and let's be honest, the crowd was a major part of what made ECW so great, you know?
Absolutely.
And this gives a really good representation of that, you know, not just them handing the guys the gimmicks to use. I mean, like the way, you know, the sign guy, and then there were, you know, all the different, you know, just the visceral reaction to what they were seeing was really fantastic. Then, of course, at the end of the match, you have Dreamer holds Beulah up. And then, of course, the skirt falls down. You get the full panty shot, which, as a guy, I certainly appreciated. I'm not sure the ladies watching this match would be so appreciative. But that was part of what the guys in the arena were looking for. Let's be honest. And they gave it to them.
They did. And it's, you know, look, what was her name? Kimona Wanalea.
Yes.
Which is, I mean, that's one of the great names too. There's when the match starts, and I thought this was great, and this was kind of unique. I don't think this was the intent, but Dreamer and Raven actually start to fight backstage. And for the first time in pro wrestling history, there's no cameras back there. Thank God. Right. Because I absolutely hate that. But as they're backstage fighting, the crowd is left to, I guess, keep themselves occupied. So they start chanting at Beulah, show your tits. Which again is what the ECW crowd was about. What makes that interesting was ECW, Beulah McGillicuddy, actually posed nude for a men's magazine in the early 90s. I forget what name she used, but the photos were out there. And when I found that
I'm going to need the name of that magazine, Barry.
Yeah, exactly. And she looked, let's be honest, she looked absolutely fantastic too, but she did do some nude modeling. So her breasts had already been exposed. Beautiful, beautiful woman. I always thought, I think her real name is Teresa something. Just a beautiful, beautiful woman. Of course, ironically, she and Tommy Dreamer have been married for years. They have twin daughters. Tommy was running shows in Philly at the old ECW arena, which is, I think he renamed it the House of Hardcore Arena, but Beulah would always be there. Their daughters would always be there. And it was pretty cool to see too. So Jeff, did you ever go to a live show and see a live ECW show in the old ECW arena? I saw it before Lauderdale.
I in fact did. I went up with Dave Flaherty for one show and, I got to sit with Dave Shearer up in the, what do they call it? Not the crow's nest, but up in those balcony seats. Sure. And I watched it. And then I can tell you, I really don't remember what the main event was, but I remember that was the show where they shot the angle with Atsushi Onita backstage. And now I can't even remember if it was a Sandman or with Dreamer, where they were going to bring that match over to Japan to FMW. And they shot the angle and then it ended up like not going anywhere. They never followed up on the angle, but, yeah, it was the show. So I'm sure somebody out there
will know what I'm talking about. It was a show where Atsushi Onita was at the arena that night. And yeah, it was tons of fun. We had a great time. Matter of fact, I'm thinking now, I think Oben Johnson was with us also for that.
I was there twice. I sat with Dave Shearer as well. Remember Jeff Lynch, the old guy that used to put out the tapes, and he would have put out these huge lists. Jeff
was like
Lynch
from Pittsburgh, wasn't he?
He was from, you know what? That's right. He was from Pittsburgh. Great guy. He like disappeared. He was a great guy. Dave Shearer and a bunch of other people. What struck me, I was living in New York at the time. So I took the bus down. Shearer picked me up in Atlantic City. I took a bus to Atlantic City. He picked me up, drove me to the arena. But a couple of things struck me. This was the ECW crowd in the heyday of ECW was arguably the toughest pro wrestling crowd in the history of the modern era. And, I had seen plenty of live wrestling shows, but you get to the ECW arena, you know, it's like fucking game on. And even the cops might have been the toughest cops. I never had experienced cops like saying, get the fuck out of here. I'm going to beat your ass. Like, you know, like all this, it was just very bizarre to me. And I was like, Dave, what's, you know, and Dave goes, this is every show. This is how they get people out of the building at the end of the show. But I think that was, you know, that was a really borderline tough environment in a lot of ways. I had no issues with the two times I was there. Fans are fans. I don't think they're going there to fight, but I'm sure fights were taking place. But it was a lot of fun. It was reckless. It was lawlessness. You know, it was carelessness at times. Security was real tough. It's a lot of the same security guys.
What was the name of the security company? There was one company.
Atlas.
Okay. You know, here's the thing that bothered me. And I'm not talking about a show in Philadelphia. I saw this because I went to more than a few shows at the venerable War Memorial Auditorium in Fort Lauderdale when ECW came down. But especially the Dudleys and Bubba Ray specifically would almost try to goad the people into coming over the ring barrier. And, you know, it's one thing to interact, but, you know, guys like, you know, Buddy Colt and Johnny Valentine and all those guys, they used to interact with the fans and you know, kind of say, what you going to do and all that. But you know what? They never crossed that line to where they were almost inviting the people to come on. And then, of course, they would beat their ass. And that just always bothered me that, you know, it's like, okay, interact with them. Tell them they're, you know, friggin' scumbags, whatever. But don't cross that threshold where you invite them to come across the thing, because then if you do get in the fight, it's almost like, I don't want to make this into a whole legal thing, but you know, the whole probable cause, it's like, it's not trespassing if you invited someone in your house, you know what I mean? And so that, I mean, I remember that from court. So if Bubba Ray, if he invites someone to come across and they do, and they get it in, of course, not that I think anyone's going to beat him, in a fight, but is the guy truly, you know, if he gets tossed out of the building for doing that, is it really fair? Because of course the first reaction from any good security guy, oh, the guy's across the barrier, toss his ass out of the building. And I completely get that. But if the wrestler is inviting the guy, that's kind of a gray area to me.
I mean, I agree with you, but it shouldn't even be a gray area at that stage. If you're inviting somebody to come in and then but I don't think that they were going to have the guy arrested. I think if a guy got in the ring, I think Bubba Ray legitimately would have beat the shit out of the guy.
No, absolutely.
But he did that. And he did that a lot. I mean, that was his gimmick. And I got to tell you, it was, I always felt that he was going too far. I think that's what it was supposed to be. But Jeff, let's get on to important subjects. I did a little bit of internet research. There isn't just photos of Beulah.
Oh,
there
my.
Is a there's a video, my friend.
Okay. After the show today, we will be
we're going to be reviewing this video next week. Right,
yes,
Jeff?
That will be a part of that. That'll be our movie of the week. So we're going to be inviting guys to review that.
Holy
film. No, anyway.
Cow.
So if you get a chance, this is not Eddie Guerrero versus Dean Malenko or Benoit versus one of the Mexican guys. But if you're looking for capturing a moment in time, this I think really does a great job of capturing a moment in time. I love the character of Raven. And by the way, you know, a lot of people talk, when you talk about the great flunkies of all time, you know, Jack Victory with the Sheep Herders was a great flunky, but you know, Stevie here as Raven's flunky is absolutely tremendous.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I think, and Stevie, I want to say he lives down in South Florida. He's a personal trainer. He's a guy that kind of got out of wrestling and just moved on. You really don't hear much about him. I think he's got a nice, stable life, but he did a great job. You know, they let Stevie do the talking, not even Raven. They were letting Stevie do the talking.
Yeah, and I used to love that he would wear the cutoff shirt with his belly exposed and the short shorts, just like so out of time, like it was like from the 80s, and he was like 10 years behind. It was fantastic. And really, that was a gimmick we didn't mention that we should have. So now, Barry, before we move past, I have one more wrestling-related question that I'm going to ask you about. And to do so, I'm going to tell a little story here. So my sister... Shout out to my sister, Rain Williams, who you, of course, have met. My sister went to high school in Key West, Florida. My father was stationed down there when there was still a naval base in Key West. And so she went to the Venerable Mary Immaculate Catholic High School in Key West, and she was a cheerleader for the basketball team. Now, as you can imagine, you ever been to Key West, by the way?
Oh, many times.
Absolutely. Okay. It's basically in the middle of this tropical paradise, this real small town. Okay. And so it's kind of one of these things where everybody kind of knows everybody. And what happened was in her senior year, oh, I'm going to hazard a guess here. I think it was 72 or 73, right in that time frame. She was a cheerleader for the Mary Immaculate Catholic High School basketball team. And that is, you know, as a young kid at that point, I was probably 10 or 11 years old, and I would go to a few basketball games. My parents would take them. Yeah. And we were going to see my sister cheer, of course. But the basketball team that year was really good, and they went to state. Okay. I can't remember if they won state, but they at least were like maybe in the quarterfinals, semifinals. So here I am now. I'm talking some, 45 plus years later, maybe even more than that. And I can remember still names like Rodney Ferguson, John Albury, Toby Alpizar. Those are the guys who are on the basketball team, right? And these guys, after they went to state, they didn't, like I said, they didn't win, but they were, you know, semifinals maybe. They got scholarships to go to different colleges. And the majority of them were like in, you know, I think like Miami-Dade Community College, maybe University of Miami, something like that, where it wasn't, you know, it wasn't like they were getting a basketball scholarship to go to, you know, UCLA or something. And what happened was when these kids from Key West, small town, Florida, went up to the big city, to Miami, they were completely like fish out of water, Barry. They were small town kids now in the big city, and all the stuff that had made them such a great high school basketball team now was completely gone. And every single one of those guys ended up coming back to Key West. Okay. And the reason I bring this up, so Barry, what we had there was, as I said, you were a big fish in a small pond in Key West. When you went up to Miami, even at a school like Miami-Dade Community College, you were a small fish in a really big pond. So Barry, tell me the first guy that comes to your mind in wrestling that's a guy that was a big fish in a small pond that wouldn't end up going to the, oh, let's say the big pond and found out he was really a small fish.
Okay, so a guy who was a big star in a smaller regional promotion, thought of himself as a big star, gets to the big show, and then turns out he's not what he thought he was, or at least doesn't get the push. Is that correct?
Captured my thinking 100%. Barry, you're 100% right.
I think you can look at check. I think you can look at any number of guys, especially going back to the national expansion, let's say 84 through 86, that may have been down south, that may have gone up to New York. And let's take Mr. Wrestling 2. And maybe that's not a great comparison, only because he was certainly at the tail end of his career. But Mr. Wrestling 2 had been a big star just a couple of years earlier in Mid-South, where he had been a fantastic babyface and even better heel. Before that, he had been in Florida, and obviously before that, he had had this great run in Georgia. So here was a guy that, even though he wasn't in, quote-unquote, a national promotion, had worked in the territories and was the top dog in all those territories that he worked in. And then he got up to New York And granted, he's at the tail end of his career, but for the most part, he's either prelim, mid-card, and he's doing jobs for everybody. So I don't know if that's a true comparison because he was, but Buzz Sawyer, maybe Buzz Sawyer is a better Missing Link. There's another one. Look, Missing Link was a guy that was a big fish, especially, you know, world-class Wild West wrestling. And then he gets up to New York and he's gone within 3 weeks. Buzz Sawyer, probably the same thing. Buzz Sawyer, big deal in a lot of promotions, had all the talent in the world, gets up to New York, maybe makes it 2 or 3 weeks. And I don't know if it's so much even that that they were the big fish in a small pond, and then it's the small fish in a big pond, as opposed to personal issues. But those are guys that immediately come to mind for me.
Well, okay. First of all, if you really wanted to look at what I was talking about, and I had one guy that popped into my mind right away when I thought about this whole thing. But before I get to him, you know, there's a lot of guys in ECW that could definitely fall in that category.
Absolutely.
Guys who are huge deals in ECW that for whatever reason never translated, to, let's just say, an equal amount of success, like when they went to, whether it was the WWE or WCW. You know, I mentioned Raven.
This, Jeff, not to interrupt you, but how many guys in ECW actually became as big or bigger stars outside of ECW? Take out the Dudley Boys, who I think became huge.
Sure, that's fair.
Terry Funk, who doesn't count in my opinion because he was a massive star beforehand, but how many guys truly lived up to their potential? Or I don't know if that's even the correct
word. I don't know. Would you say Rob Van Dam, RVD? Would
that's
he
a good one? That's, yeah, and I'll tell you why. Because when I think a guy like Eddie Guerrero, I don't think of as ECW, and I know that that's
no. And then I was referring to the basically the guys that are seen almost as like, I mean, Steve Austin went through ECW for God's sakes. Yeah, I'm not talking about guys like that.
Right.
I'm talking about guys who were seen as ECW lifers. The Dudley
Van Damme is a great one.
Yeah. Absolutely transcended ECW and made themselves into a huge deal in the WWE. RVD, he started slow, but then for every person like that, you had guys like Raven who, for whatever reason, whether it was the Booker did not get the gimmick, in WCW or in WWE, he just never became what he was in. And Tommy Dreamer's another one, never became what he was in ECW. They just maybe, yeah. Oh, and who can forget the outrage, folks? If you think people are outraged at Dave Meltzer because of some perceived AEW connection, like that's their guy, that's his guys. You should recall back to the mid 90s, the way people would absolutely lose their mind because Dave Meltzer took a critical review of Sabu's matches, and people right. in the ECW arena that would watch Sabu, like he was, let's be honest, like he was the, in fact, Sheik. And Dave would write a review and give it, it's just 2.5 stars. What? Oh my God. They would lose their fucking minds. And if you go back and you watch a Sabu match from 25 years ago, it's really, you body slam a guy and then you take 30 seconds to set up a table. And how many times did you see, I can remember a match where Sabu had a chair in the ring and then he went to jump, the chair fell over. So he goes and sets the chair back up.
That's right.
Then he goes and to do the jump from the chair to the ring rope, except he kind of stumbles a little bit. So he goes back and all the while the guy's laying down on the, it's like, come on, what happened to a smooth transition here? And yeah, of course he would do the stuff where he jumped through a table and you sit there and go, oh my God, this guy is just killing himself and he's scarring himself up something horrible. And you had that barbed wire match where he caught the barbed wire in his arm and it just like just horribly disgusting. I felt bad for the guy because he was literally scarring himself up for these people to enjoy. And that's part of what kind of began to turn the whole room on what they were doing was they stopped with the Eddie Guerrero and the Mexican guys and Benoit and Malenko. And they would throw in where guys would sit there and beat each other over the head with a trash can or just, jump off balconies. And you knew these guys weren't getting tons of money. And that's my main complaint about that. But anyway, getting back to the guy that I originally thought of, getting back to the big fish, small pond, was Buddy Rose. Because Buddy Rose in Portland was a huge deal. I can hear Kevin Orcutt now. And, you know, and then when he went to New York, he was, you know, when he first got the title shots, everyone was like, who is this guy? And why is he getting title shots against, you know, whether it's Morales or Backlund or whatever. And then he went back to Portland, was a big deal again, goes to AEW, or I'm sorry, not AEW, AWA, and was tag champs with Doug Summers. It was a really solid heel team. But by that time, he started putting weight on. And it was kind of like, really, this is the guy. And he was a tremendous character out in Portland. He was fantastic. And, you know, like if you ever get a chance to watch some of the stuff from the late 70s and early 80s that's out there on YouTube of Buddy Rose as the lead heel in Portland, he was fantastic, Barry.
Yeah, I'll give you another guy, too, that came to mind was the Rebel Dick Slater. And Dick Slater, who, you know, he was a top star anywhere he had been, gets to the WWE and they made him a baby face called the Rebel that carries a Confederate flag. And,
yeah, wasn't working out so well in New York.
Northeast, yeah. You know, first off, you know, there's like no thought given to it. And then Slater was gone just after a few months. And I don't think he was ever quite the same after that really just botched run in the Federation. But there were a bunch of guys, you know, I was always happy when a guy like Roddy Piper or Paul Orndorff, when they made it. You know, because a guy like Orndorff, we had seen for years in different territories, Piper as well, and we knew the talent was there. So to go up to New York and make it is great. But you're right, though. There were a lot of guys that really couldn't make it. And it's, you know, it to me, it all comes down to who decides who's going to make it and who's not going to make it. Honky Tonk Man, I think, is a great one because on the surface, not a great wrestler. And we discussed Honky just a couple of weeks ago. Not a great wrestler, you know, not having really, you know, 4-star matches, but a guy that was, I don't know if he was even a top talent. You know, he was a lot of either tag team or mid card and gets up to New York and really does become a big deal in New York. He kind of completely, you know, completely threw off the curve on that one. So interesting question.
Yeah, no, and very fair, you know, that he took that character and ran with it.
He did.
You know, there's a lot of guys that were given characters and they didn't really fully embrace the character and what, you know, their, I guess, Vince's vision of what the character was. You know, you mentioned Dick Slater. I remember after he left a couple years later, he teamed up in WCW with Dick Murdoch as the Hardliners. And of course, the inside joke on the sheets was that they weren't the Hardliners. They were the Hard Dicks. And so, remember that? That was pretty funny.
Jeff, I just want to jump in here. We got a message from Sweet Lou correcting me.
What?
On the Missy Hyatt, Paul Verlin story. Missy's story is that she promised Varlin something if he put Taz over. Then after the match, she told him, "I don't fuck jabronis."
Okay, let's clarify that one more time for the litigants.
Yes.
Barry's story was incorrect, and Missy did not fuck jabronis. So, yeah. I think that absolves legally. So, now, Barry, one more food-related item. Actually, I have two more food-related items, but another food-related question here, Barry. Barry, the wife and I the other night were watching MasterChef, okay? The fine program with Gordon Ramsay. You're literally trying to kill the customer. That's my Gordon Ramsay impression. And so every week on MasterChef, when they have the dinner, there's always, I use this term very loosely, a celebrity or two that will come in. Okay. Like last week he had like Wayne Brady. Okay. You know who Wayne Brady is?
Oh yeah. I know.
Okay. So that was the big celebrity, but the other celebrity that came in was Lisa Vanderpump. Do you know who this is?
I do know who she is. I'm sad to admit, but I know who she is.
She's like somebody, I think that is, like a Kardashian is kind of famous for being famous.
Yes.
And I know she has some reality show. I don't know what it is. But so here, the reason I'm bringing this up is because I want to ask you, Barry, she brought into Gordon Ramsay's, you know, a restaurant, which let's be honest, this is supposed to be high end. Okay. Celebrity chef, Gordon Ramsay's restaurant, whether it has Michelin stars or not, I don't know. She brought her dog into the restaurant, Barry. And it's like one of those little smaller than your boy there, Mr. What's his name?
You know, like Noodles.
Mr. Noodles. Yeah. He's like the one of these dogs.
Yeah.
That's like 5 or 10 pounds. And so she's sitting at the dinner table and she's got the dog in her hand and they're watching Gordon, you know, chew out the chefs in the kitchen because they screwed up the scallops or something like that. So my question to you, Barry, as a person who spent their life in the food service industry, where do you stand on people bringing an animal? And this is not a service animal. That's a completely different story. Bringing their fucking little dog into a restaurant where food is being prepared and served. Where do you stand?
Sure. So a little backstory on this. So the show is called Vanderpump Rules. And
I'll take your word for it.
Yes, I believe she might have even been one of those Real Housewives of Beverly Hills, but I'm not sure of that.
Based on the amount of alleged plastic surgery, I'd say you were probably right.
And you are right. She is a Kardashian in the sense that she's famous for being famous. She's never really done much. But let me give another little piece of context to this. She knows Gordon Ramsay to some degree, is my guess. They both have a food and beverage outlet at Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas. She has got a bar lounge inside that is absolutely beautiful. I did not go, but I saw it. And he has got one of his restaurants there, which is, I think it's like Hellfire Kitchen, or I forget what it's called, but there is something to that. The other aspect is that I believe, and I don't know if this is different by state or not, but essentially, at least in most states that I'm aware of, it's illegal to bring a non-service dog into a restaurant. You can sit outside. I sit outside with Ozzy all the time in a restaurant, but if I attempted to bring Ozzy into a restaurant and he's not a service dog, I am breaking the law. So what I think we were seeing was something that was gimmicked for television, that she's carrying her dog. With that being said, how fucking pretentious is it that, what was it, a Yorkie? Is her dog a Yorkie? It's gotta be, right?
No, it looked like one of those things that's like a rat terrier, but it's got long hair, like a Pomeranian, something like that.
Ugh. Okay. Unless you have a Pomeranian. Like, that's dog.
Yeah, absolutely. But it's a dog that people that love dogs don't get Pomeranians. That's a dog you get to show off to your girlfriends or something like that. That's what
Lisa Vanderpump gets. She gets to me, it's completely gimmicked for the show. If you and I walked in carrying a Pomeranian into Gordon Ramsay's restaurant, they would ask us to leave. And if we didn't, we would wind up being arrested.
Yeah. And rightfully so, I think,
I agree.
I don't understand these people. Like, we go to the grocery store and we'll see some lady walking around with a dog. I'm like, hey, you don't find anybody that loves dogs more. Gunny is my running mate, man, but I'm not bringing Gunny into Publix with me. You know, I mean, that's just insane. That's an argument for another time, Barry. Now, Barry, let's talk some TV shows that you and I have started watching recently. Now, if you were to ask me, let's say a week ago, what was the greatest show, Jeff, that you've ever seen from HBO? Of course, you come up with Game of Thrones. You come up with what we mentioned before, Boardwalk Empire. And of course, my all-time favorite is Deadwood. Okay. So upon a conversation I had not only with Barry, but with executive producer, the great Brian Last. And I said, so The Sopranos and The Wire, I have never watched an episode. Well, I shouldn't say that. I actually... probably 20 years ago, I watched one episode of Sopranos. And as I think I've said, either on the board or here, I saw it and I kind of went, it's okay. It just didn't immediately grab me. Okay. So I didn't continue watching it. Now I've had friends say, oh my God, you have to watch The Sopranos. It's the greatest show in the history of television. And then I had other people say, oh no, The Wire is the fucking bomb, man. This is the greatest thing ever. And I know that a guy that was actually the guy that plays Omar on The Wire, was on Boardwalk Empire.
He played Chalky.
Yes, that's what I was going to say.
Michael Little. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, very good actor. So what I did was I said, okay, so which one of these two shows am I going to watch? So I went to my old standby, my friend, the IMDb page, and I said, I'm going to watch the show that is rated higher by IMDb. And I went there, and I want to say The Sopranos is rated like 9.3 or 9.4. And then I went to The Wire, and The Wire was rated 9.4 or 9.5, like literally a percentage point higher than The Sopranos. And so, folks, I have begun watching The Wire. Wow, Barry, what a fucking show this is. And I got to admit, the people that have been trying to get me to watch this show for years, you were absolutely fucking right. This show is completely amazing. And, you know, it's one of these shows, Barry, when I first started watching the show, there are so many different like people within the show, characters that you have to understand who they are, what their role is in the series. And you know, there's just a lot of cooks in the kitchen, shall we say. And, but, you know, we mentioned the guy that plays Omar. But as I started watching it, I would go, oh, that guy, like the actor Wendell Pierce. Okay.
Yes.
Who plays, the character of Bunk on the show. I was like, oh, I know Bunk. Bunk was in, Amazon Prime's, Jack Ryan show with John Krasinski. That's where I know him from. And then we got, Seth Gillum, who plays one of the detectives in the show. Seth Gillum is in The Walking Dead.
That's
right. You know, so there's all these different, and then the guy that plays the lead heel, at least as far as, oh, and Idris Elba, who's always great in everything he does.
Stringer.
Yes. And then the guy that plays Avon Barksdale, the actor's name, it's Julius something. I got to find him here. Shit. Let me see. Hold on one second. He's the guy that was one of the defensive players in Remember the Titans. You know the actor I'm talking about?
I do. I don't know what his name, but I know who you're talking about.
And he's a fantastic actor. He plays the lead heel, at least in season one, who's a character. His name is Wood Harris. Thank you, Lou. I appreciate that. And he's fantastic in this. But what's great about The Wire, Barry, is there is a scene, I want to say second or third episode, okay? And one of the actors who plays sort of a low-level street dealer, and it's a guy who, matter of fact, was on the aforementioned Boardwalk Empire. And he comes up to a bunch of young guys that are working the streets for him, and he's talking to them, and they're playing checkers, but they're using a chessboard. And he comes up, and he starts kind of giving them the business about it. He goes, what are you guys playing? Why don't you play chess instead of checkers? Chess is so much more of an interesting game. And the kids are like, well, we don't know how to play chess. We, you know, leave us alone. We're just doing this. So he begins explaining the rules of chess, and he begins explaining what all the different figures on a chessboard represent. And as he's doing this, you realize that he's basically explaining the hierarchy of the drug gang in Baltimore, and how the pawns are the foot soldiers, and the queens are basically like the hitmen. They can move around and they have a specific assigned role, and that the king is like the leader of the gang, the Avon Barksdale, you know, and nothing could touch him because all his soldiers are around him. And it was at that point I went, holy shit, that's like a really great scene. And it was really well written and well acted. But then what also is great is they cut away. And one of the things I really enjoy about the show, Barry, is it doesn't just show like the drug gang. It shows the police and how they're trying to counteract the drug gang. It shows the police administration. It shows the court system and how the court system is dealing with the drug gang. And so it's like this revolving hamster on a wheel. And you get a look at all the different aspects of this, you know, situation that's going on. Now I'm talking about a show that came out in 2002, by the way. I can't believe it's been 19 years and I didn't see this show. And so that's pretty fascinating to me. But what's really interesting is that each of these groups that I mentioned, the police administration, the police unit that's taken on the drug gang, the court system, they, much like the drug gang, are chess pieces on a board where there's people that are like, you know, the cops are after the game. They're the foot soldiers. Then the administration, you know, they're the, you know, and it is really just, it fascinated me the way that they compared it to the chessboard and how spot on that was, Barry.
Yeah. So I got to admit, I'm a little envious. A lot of people will tell you, and I, whether it was Time Magazine, Rolling Stone, but a very influential publication actually named The Wire the greatest TV show of all time. And most critics, there's a lot of shitty critics out there, but most critics, at least ones we like, have put it in the top five of greatest TV shows of all time. But I'm envious, Jeff, because when I watched it, and I don't remember a lot of the details because I was watching it when it was taking place. So I think it was on Sundays that The Wire was on, and I would watch it every Sunday. But the fact that you get to binge watch it, which has got to be, to me, the ultimate experience for The Wire, I may actually go back and binge watch because it's going to be completely different in doing that. I to that point, I think you made the right choice, The Wire versus Sopranos. You know, this is a very, very polarizing figure, especially in our group. And there were people actually getting into it last week or the week before on The Sopranos. And I always felt Sopranos was a good TV show. It was definitely overrated, over romanticized. I felt that there were times it was sluggish. Certainly, James Gandolfini is probably one of the great TV characters, Tony Soprano, of all time. I'm not taking away from him, but I do feel that at times there were too many plot holes. There were too many storylines that were not being resolved, and I just wasn't into it. With The Wire, it was a roller coaster ride. I always, again, I was white knuckling the couch in certain weeks and watching it. And you had some amazing actors, and you mentioned a lot of the guys, but you know, Idris Elba is just, you know, yeah, this guy is great chance he's going to be the next James Bond. He's just a tremendous actor. Michael Little playing, who we knew as Chalky from Boardwalk Empire. He's good in everything. You know, I've never seen this guy not be good in something. The Wire was riveting, though. It was realistic. It was gritty. What was that show that was on for years that took place in Baltimore? Homicide, Life on the Streets. Remember that show?
Yes.
Yeah. So this is like Homicide, Life on the Streets. A little bit, but it goes to the next level because it was on HBO. It wasn't on NBC, so they had the luxury. Highly recommended from my side, though, Jeff.
So I want to mention a couple other things real quick. The actor, I was trying to think of, because I was going to tell a story. Lawrence Gilliard Jr. was on The Great. Deuce.
He was on The Deuce. He played the cop.
Yes, and he plays Avon Barksdale's nephew, D'Angelo. He's really strong. But I want to tell a great story that I read. The actor, I'm trying to find him now, that played Bubbles. And Bubbles is the informant. And apparently there's a story that he told that Bubbles was out. They filmed this on location in Baltimore. Okay. And Bubbles is out on the streets getting ready to film a scene. And he plays the informant, who's like this, a crack addict, a heroin addict, whatever. And he's there. And he said a guy walked up to him and put something in the palm of his hand. And he goes, "Here, man, you look like you need a little something to help you out." And he opened his pot, and the guy walked away, and the guy had given him something, like a little hit. And he goes, "That to me was like getting the Academy Award. That told me that my performance as this addict was so believable that the addicts on the street were coming up and giving him shit." That's hilarious, you know?
Anyway,
a fantastic show. I look forward to seeing the rest of the stuff. Andre Rojo, thank you, Lou, was the actor that played Bubbles, and he is fantastic, disheveled. And the guy that played his like not partner, but his friend on the street is an actor, the guy that got beat up by the gang. He was a white guy with bleach blonde hair. But what was great was he had, like, his teeth were all nasty and yellow. And when one of the cops was trying to dress up to go undercover as an addict, that's one of the things they told him. "Well, first of all, your teeth are too white, so they're going to know you're a cop right away, you know, and you don't look, you got a 4-day beard growth, but your shoes are brand new. You don't have any holes in them." And they talked about how an addict is, you're going to be able to tell them by their shoes because they're used to walking over needles, you know, so there's all kind of holes in their shoes, which I thought was pretty amazing and a pretty amazing point. So anyway, The Wire, tremendous show. Now, as if that wasn't enough, Barry, let's talk about another show that you and I both binged. Did you get a chance to finish the show I'm going to mention?
Oh, I absolutely did.
Okay. Let's talk about, on Netflix, recently debuting Richard Ramirez, The Night Stalker. How fucking amazing is this show?
This was great. This was great. And it was, what I liked first off was that there really was no filler to this. This essentially is four episodes, give or take 45 minutes to an hour for each episode. So, you're looking at somewhere between 3 and 4 hours. And I thought I knew a lot about The Night Stalker, and I didn't know jack shit about The Night Stalker, as it turned out, because I learned so much. What I really liked what they did with this is they really make the two lead investigators, the two lead in homicide investigators, which is Frank Salerno and Gil Carrillo. They make them the focus of the show and what they had to go through and what this case meant. Not just to them personally, but to their families, to their lives. And, you know, Gil Carrillo tells a story of how he separated from his wife because she was so fed up with the fact that 20 hours per day, this is all he did, 7 days a week. And Frank Salerno, you can see Frank Salerno is, you could tell by his personality that this deeply affected him. You know, he's very
the guy that's had a hard life. He don't
very hard life.
Sort of reminded me, not exactly, but he sort of put to mind Lawrence Tierney to me.
Yeah, you know, yeah. That's actually that's a
vet, you know, kind of thing. So anyway, go ahead.
No smile, never raises his voice. He has got this monotone inflection and a stare out of his eyes that's almost blank at times when he speaks. Like this guy has seen shit and it has stayed with him. You know what I mean? And that's what I got from Frank Salerno. Gil Carrillo seems to have a sense of humor, but I thought this was fantastic. And this was, I learned so much. You and I were texting and talking about this, but I never realized that he kind of started off molesting children. And they interview one of his victims, a young lady who is still, you know, to this day, I believe, just based off of the interview she gave, she's still haunted by this. This has not left her at all. And then you read some of the stories of what he was doing to people before he was killing them. And then after he was killing them, gouging out of the eyes and the rapes. And Richard Ramirez may be one of the worst of all time when it comes to serial killers. At least, you know, there's been some pretty bad ones that were out there. But did you know how Richard Ramirez was caught? I had no idea, Jeff.
You know, as I was watching the scene as it developed, you know, as they do flashback news footage of when he was caught, I kind of went, oh, God, that's right. I do remember this. And I remember that story of him being captured and exactly how they captured him. Now, let me just say some of the stuff Barry was talking about, especially in regards to children. Not only that, but what was so weird about Ramirez, amongst about a million things, was his complete lack of a pattern. Like, he would go into some homes and he'd rape the people or he'd rape the women. He would shoot the husband dead, but leave the wife alive and then not bother anything in the house. Then there was other times where he would go into a house. He would kill both people and, you know, he would maybe steal something. He would actually sit and have like something to eat. And
melon.
Then like,
remember
yeah,
that one?
Yeah.
Fucking melon.
And then there was, you know, times where he would pick a child up and he would sexually assault a child, or he would, you know, do that. And then there were other times where he would like, just like sort of scare him and leave him. And then what about the guy who actually apparently worked for LAPD or the LA Sheriff's Office, whose wife, is out in the living room, I think, and hears something and calls out to her husband. She says, "You're going to wake the kids up." And it's a window opening up, and the guy goes and gets his gun and is going to where this window that apparently they had painted shut to where it was open. Yeah. They realized that something was wrong. And he says, "Holy shit, I got to call the cops." And then he went, "Wait a minute, I am the cops." So, which was kind of, you know, it was funny in retrospect. But just the way this guy it wasn't like he was picking on white people, black people, Asian people, Hispanic people. He chose everybody completely at random. And he was all over the Los Angeles area, you know, and a lot of these towns that I, you know, or cities within that area that I don't know so well. But he was literally going, and I guess like LA has like something like 5, 6, 7, maybe even 8 counties surrounding it, you know. And, you know, the jurisdictional issues between going from, say, you know, like where I used to live, Broward County was Fort Lauderdale. Miami was Dade County. Okay. If you go and commit a crime in Miami and then go and commit a crime in Broward, that's two separate different, you know, prosecutor's office that are going after you, plus the police department's involved. And how, you know, one of the things they talked about was initially how the police departments didn't want to share information because everybody wanted to get credit for catching the guy, you know, and how just screwed up that whole line of thinking is. And then after all that, the guy would go up to San Francisco and he like killed an Asian couple up in San Francisco. So now you have the San Francisco police involved, and then they do a press conference and they, what do you call that? Cause they had the whole clue where the killer they knew was wearing a Via sneakers. And, so was it Diane Feinstein? Was that what she admitted?
Yes.
The killer is wearing a Via sneakers. And apparently it was a sneaker that was so rare that literally only one of those sneakers had been sold in Los Angeles. They
one
like did all the
pair.
Yes.
That of black Avias was sold, which obviously went to the Night Stalker. So what does the mayor of San Francisco do? She holds a fucking press conference and gives away all of the clues of to the identity of this person. As I'm watching it, I was getting mad, but Gil Carrillo and Salerno apparently just had the biggest fucking shit fit when this happened, that she completely compromised the case.
Yeah. And then it, to the point where the sheriff in Los Angeles had to get on and do a press conference and say, well, it's not any easier when you have certain politicians, you know, like giving out, and one of the things that Salerno said was they never found the sneakers after that. The sneakers disappeared. Right. And, but that was one of the prime clues, was that every scene and all these murders leading up to where he got caught was there was a shoe print that this guy was leaving, like whether it was in the victims, whether it was blood on the floor that he stepped in. The guy that I mentioned, the police officer whose window was, out in the dirt in his lawn by the window, there was the Avia shoe print. So that was what tied them to everything. And then the fact that they had, there was the other thing, Barry, where there had been a thumbprint that was left on a rear view mirror, and they put it was like the LA Sheriff's Office gave it to the Los Angeles Police Department. They put it in their storage and they said, okay, we need you to dust this car and get a print off the thing. And they let it sit there for how long? And it was like, oh yeah, we haven't done that yet. You know? And in between there were like four more murders, you know? Yeah,
the one thing I got from it, and you're right about all that too, is that you look at the amount of crimes that took place in Los Angeles, whether, you know, and I don't know what county, but in the Los Angeles region, as far as they knew, there was only one actual murder, which was Peter Pan was the guy's name. And then I believe his wife was
brutalized. Right?
But who actually solves the crime? The San Francisco detective.
Yeah.
So it, which really had to really frost the ass of Salerno and Carrillo, that the guy out in San Francisco was able to actually crack the case. But it was riveting. And they got to the point where there was this whole back and forth with the media. And it was one television reporter, a female. I completely forget what her name was.
She's still out in LA, apparently.
Yeah, it looks like it, right? But yeah. So there was this whole back and forth, and they decided to release the information on who this guy was, because the guy, again, the lead detective in San Francisco, had figured out that this guy, Jeff, we didn't even talk about this. They make Carrillo, who has been sitting in a dentist office for a week or so, leave, and they put in an emergency button that when this guy shows up, because they knew that he had an infected tooth, he was going to show up at the dentist office. The day that Carrillo is not there, Richard Ramirez shows up. The dentist is pressing the emergency button. It's faulty. It doesn't work.
Yeah, that's just amazing. Yeah. So then let's get to, so he gets arrested. Okay. And what happens is he's visiting his brother in Arizona, comes back and basically sees his picture in a paper that was, this is the guy we're looking for. And he kind of starts wandering away. And then all these people start saying, hey, that's the guy that's in the paper. That's the guy they're looking for. And these citizens he goes through a predominantly Hispanic neighborhood. They're chasing him down the street. And the cops block off the part that he's running towards, and probably this is very ironic, kind of save his life at that point, because the neighborhood people were basically going to kill the guy.
Oh yeah.
They were either going to, just beat him to death or whatever. And they put him in a substation to process him. And the substation is completely surrounded. Like, remember that film Assault on Precinct 13?
Sure.
We need to get the hell out of here and get to the main, main jail, because we're not safe here. And they, they hustle him out of there, and they literally have a, and they say it's only like maybe 2-3 miles away from the main jail, but there's a police procession, just because literally lining the streets are all these people in this predominantly Hispanic neighborhood that want to kill the guy, because he's literally has the town, the city of Los Angeles, not just the Hispanics, not just the Asians, not just the blacks, the whites, everybody is completely freaked out and petrified by the fact that this guy's out there. So now they finally capture him, and they want to do a little street justice to the guy. So the guy gets processed in, comes into jail. They appoint two guys or he get his father hires two guys who are lawyers who have been practicing for 2 years, of course. And there's some concern that these guys aren't, you know, savvy enough, shall we say, legally savvy enough to handle a case that has this sort of tentacles to it. And, you know, the only thing I can compare it to, Barry, is, you know, I mentioned a couple years ago now, geez, I can't believe it's been that long, the Parkland shooting that happened at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School.
Right.
And the kid killed what, like, I think it was like 17 students and maybe a teacher or a police officer here or there. And, you know, because I worked in the court system, I know just how, wow, just what a mess that's going to be. I mean, you'd love to hear a case like that. Oh, we want this guy brought to trial in 3 months. No, because there's, yeah, they've got to be deposition. It's not just one murder where there's all these depositions and all this, you know, legal procedure that has to happen, you know, and then with that kid, you got all the psychological evaluations that have to happen. You have 17 different times that amount have to happen. You have to have one for every single victim. So in this case, the Ramirez case, you know, and I got to tell you, I give a lot of credit because, you know, people remember the OJ case, which was only a double. I mean, only a double homicide. And people would criticize Ito because he kind of let the lawyers run amok. But this judge must have really had his shit together because this was not something where the lawyers were really allowed to run amok. And the case just went on and on forever. But the guy enters a plea, Ramirez. He stands up, holds his palm out where he has the pentagram and says, "Hail Satan," which completely freaks out everybody, Barry, that saw that.
Yeah, it's you definitely get the impression that Ramirez didn't give a shit at that point. He knew he was caught and he was going to let the world know. But there is a scene, too. The two lawyers, and I guess Ramirez's father had, he knew these guys from El Paso or something. So that's how they were grandfathered into being Ramirez's lawyer. Clearly very unprepared, but there's a scene where the one lawyer, one of Ramirez's lawyers, says to, the prosecuting attorney, he says to him, well, if he wants to insult me, we can take it outside. Do you imagine? Yeah. It's like, what the fuck? You're in a court of law. You know, it's like, it's insane.
So let's talk about another aspect that I thought was very interesting. How about the women that developed a crush on Ramirez through his television appearances and would send him in the jail nude photos of themselves?
And let's be honest, Jeff, as you were watching that segment, as I was as well, these were really attractive women.
Yeah, these were not like, you know,
yes,
bar flies and it's 3 a.m. and you're looking for a good time and I got to get out of here. These were like, I won't say everyone, but there were a few that you were like, damn, that's a pretty good looking woman. What is, you know, and the fact that they're attracted to this guy that's accused of like 20 homicides,
a
guy that killed a father. Okay. Raped the mother and then sodomized their 8-year-old in front of the mother. And these women are sending him nude fucking photos. What the hell, Bear?
Yeah. It really was too. And as I was watching, there were a couple of blondes that looked like they could be professional models. There were a lot of topless photos being sent, but he had a lot of groupies. Then they were showing these same groupies in the courtroom, and these were attractive women, and he would wave at them. He was absolutely flirting and waving with them. And, you know, it, to me, it's astounding because I go back to like thinking of all the days I couldn't get laid, you know, and then you got this guy who's a fucking, he's not a handsome guy and he's a murderer. And yet he's got these beautiful women throwing themselves at him. So, yeah, kind of astounding, Jeff.
Just amazing. So, and you know, what was interesting was the fact that this guy had, you know, he was somebody, you have to recall, that the Hillside Strangler case had gripped Los Angeles literally like maybe less than a year before all of his Richard Ramirez Night Stalker killing started. And so apparently they said that Ramirez was almost like a student of serial killers. You know, he'd read up on Bundy. He read up on the Hillside Stranglers, which were two cousins apparently. And so this guy, when Salerno and Carrillo come in to interrogate him beginning, they go, "Hi, I'm Detective Salerno." And he goes, "Yeah, I know who you are." Like he knew who the detective was because he had followed him in the newspaper. And that's just crazy. And then at the end, when he says to him after he's been convicted, they go visit him and he says, are you going to come to my execution? And Carrillo, I think it was, said, I don't think I need to do that. You know, and Salerno goes, yep, I'm coming. You know,
yeah, they were there. It does. And that's what Carrillo even said to some degree. Carrillo said that he didn't want Ramirez to die, like in a shootout when they were trying to capture him, because he actually wanted to be able to sit down and have a conversation with him. Yes. He wanted to have some sort. So there is this bond, obviously, that's formed between, I guess, the detectives that are looking. But Jeff, I want to address too a post that I did in our Facebook group. And if you haven't joined our Facebook group, we say this all the time. The three best friends you never knew you had, Jeff, myself, Sweet Lou, we certainly encourage you to join our Facebook group. We're almost 2,000 members. We have a lot more listening to our podcast on a weekly basis. So please join us. But so I was living in Los Angeles when the Night Stalker murders and crimes were taking place, and I did not know it. And I was trying to figure, look, I get it, that stage of my life, I wasn't about news. I couldn't tell you anything that was occurring. I wasn't about that at all. But this seemed like such a big deal that this would have been in conversation between people on the street or friends. Holy shit, did you hear what the Night Stalker did or something like that? And I couldn't figure out how the fuck, up until a week ago, less than a week ago, I never realized I lived there when all this was taking place. And as I was watching the show, it became a lot more clear why that was the case. So I moved out to Los Angeles in March of 1985, and I stayed out there until late August, early September of 85. And that was essentially the entire period that the Night Stalker murders and crimes were all taking place. But as and Eric Cholminsky, our old friend Eric Cholminsky, the Japanese and music expert, was giving me a lot of shit via text about how the fuck could you like not be aware? And I said, well, first off, no television. I had no TV where I lived. I didn't watch TV once. I didn't read one newspaper at all. There was no internet or, you know, Facebook, where now if somebody farts, you find out in 30 seconds if something's taking place. I had no idea. I did listen to one radio station, but odds are I was listening only to music. And if a commercial came on, who knows what I was doing? You know, I wasn't paying attention with that. What I got from the show, and this is where it made a lot more sense to me, they didn't dub him the Night Stalker until August of 85. They did not start to put together the pieces. The media, I'm sure, you know, the police detectives were. The media wasn't aware that there was a serial killer taking place until August of 85. So that entire period of, say, March till August, these were, from the public's perspective, random killings. And why was that? To something that you said earlier, Jeff, this did not take place in a single neighborhood. He would go to all these different neighborhoods. They could be an hour to an hour and a half apart. He did not look for a specific type of person. It wasn't just male, female, Hispanic, Asian, or African American. He was targeting every race and every, you know, anything possible. He was targeting all that. It wasn't until August of 85, and they even had another nickname for him. I forget what it was called. And somebody called him the Hillside Strangler. He had like five different nicknames, and he actually liked, not Hillside Strangler, the Night Stalker. He actually liked that nickname and picked up on it and started referring to himself as the Night Stalker. So again, you know, I definitely wasn't the most aware person back then, debatable if I even am now. But at the same time, now I understand why. But imagine living through this, and I certainly couldn't have been the only one. I have a city of 10 million people or whatever's out there. I couldn't have been the only one, which is kind of frightening when you stop and think about it, Jeff.
Well, I think part of the reason also that this wasn't as out there was just the horrific nature of the crime and the fact that he was sexually assaulting children. I'm sure that's something that they didn't want to release to the press. And quite honestly, even, you know, as sensational as the press might be at times, I mean, is the press really going to put out there that he sodomized an 8-year-old as part of the story? You know, so there were things that they probably weren't, you know, maybe they weren't telling the press, or if they were telling the press about it, the press wasn't putting it out there. So that could contribute. There was one other aspect about this that I want to mention, because it was something that someone asked me about in the group when I mentioned we were going to talk about it. And that is the whole connection with AC/DC, their song. Oh God, I knew I was going to forget it. Lou, if you could help me out, what was the song that they connected AC/DC with this? But anyway, what happened while Lou's looking that up for us? They interviewed this woman that was at, like, I want to say like a thrift store or something like that. And she's looking at this hat, and it was an AC/DC hat. And she's like, oh yeah, I like that. That's okay. Maybe I'll get it if I come back around this way. It was the Night Prowler from the Highway to Hell album. And so she puts the hat back down, and as she's putting it down, she's standing there. She hasn't moved on yet. And she says a guy next to her comes and picks up the cap and puts it on and looks at her, and she says the look that he gave her was just one of like an evil look, and that he bought the hat. And then later, when she heard about that there had been an AC/DC cap found it at one of the crime scenes, she kind of went, oh my God, that was the guy. And, you know, so the connection of AC/DC to this crime is extremely thin at very best, Bear.
Yeah. And to that also, when you said about the evil stare, In the majority of either especially the photos aren't a great representation, but the photos, he's got a stare on him like no one else I've ever seen. But in a lot of the videos, you can see clearly how mentally disturbed this guy was. And then they actually, which is, I always think is a good idea, and there's certainly no sympathy, but his childhood was one of horrific abuse.
Oh my God. Yeah. We didn't even get into that. Yeah, like I'll give you one example, Barry. I'm interrupting. Maybe you were going to say this, but one of the things they talked about was that his father, apparently Richard was from very young age, was a thief and would steal just stupid shit. And to get him to stop doing that, there was at least one occasion where his father takes him down to a graveyard, finds a grave with a cross on it, and chains him to the cross and leaves him in the graveyard overnight.
Yeah.
Wow. Nice. That is quality parenting right there.
Yeah. They go through his childhood, and everybody said it, anybody that knew him, but even the detectives basically say this guy was just scarred from childhood. And, you know, to be able to do, like, when you read that he does these crimes, and here was the other aspect, which was, you know, I don't think we'll ever see a serial killer as prolific with the short time span as you did with the Night Stalker, because there was a period where he was committing murders every like day or so. Like it was every couple of days, and he was just committing these murders. And I think with the technology that we have now, I don't think it's possible that could take place any longer. But, you know, you look at the murders that he was committing, and I was horrified just watching this. Just imagine he's breaking into houses on a daily basis and murdering and torturing people. It's just frightening beyond belief. This was fantastic. I hope that these guys do something similar, maybe with other serial killers or other true crime stories in the future. I love the aspect of going through with the two detectives. I just thought that was just such a unique perspective to do it that way. This is something much like the movie we reviewed earlier in this episode. You want to seek this out. You definitely want to see this series if you can.
Yeah. And a couple of things real quick. Netflix apparently has been getting some criticism from people who feel like they allowed too much to be shown. Maybe some of the crime scene photos, some of the where they play back interviews that were done in jail.
Yeah.
And no, I'm just saying that is out there.
Can I be honest with that? My take on that, Jeff. That was the best publicity for this show.
Oh, sure. No, there's no question about it. I'm just saying.
I'm wondering if that wasn't a plant in some form, that because I know that, you know, when I heard Night Stalker, I was wrong. I assumed I knew everything about the Night Stalker, which I clearly didn't. But to the other aspect, I don't know if I would have watched this if I didn't read the headline saying this thing goes too far. It doesn't go too far at all.
Well, what I was going to say was, this is probably not something that Benji Fido is going to want Antonio to say either.
You know, yeah. So.
And I will say, as we begin to wrap up this episode, that I recently read, and I think I posted in the group, Netflix is also going to be doing a documentary on the Elisa Lam a story that we covered in one of our Unsolved Mysteries episodes, Bear. So, you know, obviously we have people at Netflix that listen to our very fine podcast here.
And, well, Jeff, I will tell you, and this is a true story, we have people that work with the WWE that actually listen to us on a weekly basis that I am aware of. But I wonder if people in Netflix are somehow, because it is interesting. We devoted, Jeff, and you did, that was a whole segment on your Unsolved Mysteries. And we both clearly said something is clearly wrong with this. Something doesn't add up to this. And now there's going to be a whole Netflix series. I'm super excited. But Jeff, tying that in, a little update on one of our stories. I did a story about Mark Tendler probably a year to a year and a half ago. And Mark Tendler was a wrestler who wrestled for the old WWWF in the Northeast. He had wrestled in Florida, I believe, in the late 50s, but was primarily a guy that spent a lot of time in the Northeast. And later, he was a prelim guy. Later in his career, he was working, allegedly working for organized crime, and was assassinated outside of a bar one night. And I remember we went through the story. This bar had seen other murders and other things taking place. He was married to a female wrestler named Kitty Adams. And as it was discovered by Leilani Kai today, she reached out. Kitty Adams passed away last month at the age of 85. She had been living in Crystal River, Florida, Jeff. And she had passed away. I believe it was COVID related. So rest in peace, Kitty Adams. Yeah, it's just a bizarre story with Mark Tendler. They never caught the killers. It is unsolved, but, you know, obviously some shit was going down there.
Yeah. So, okay. As we begin to wrap up this particular episode, I will say that on behalf of my co-host, Barry Rose, not John McAdam, in fact, Barry Rose, and our producer, the sweet man, Lou Kippelman, that Breaking Kayfabe with Bowden and Barry, a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. Till next week, I'll leave you with this question, Barry. I'll save it for next week's show, okay? Barry, if you had $175 to use on any restaurant, not In-N-Out, from a company called Goldbelly that will send you food from any restaurant in the country, do you know where you'd spend that money? Don't tell me what it is. Just say yes or no. Would you spend the money?
Oh, yes, I would. Absolutely. Okay. Yes, I would.
So next week, including Sweet Lou, who will be dragged into this conversation, we will divulge where the money is going to be being spent. And until next week, we'll be hanging. Later, folks.